Okay, so look, when you see the poster for the show we're talking about today, Half a Sixpence, be honest with me. What do you see?
You see a very cheery young man in a blazer, probably holding a banjo, flashing this huge smile that says, "I have absolutely zero problems in the world."
Exactly. It just screams quaint, British classic.
Yeah.
Looks like the kind of thing your grandparents would hum along to. It feels safe. It feels, well, honestly, a little dated.
Banjos, blazers, and big smiles, as the old critics used to say.
Right. So when I picked up this stack of research, I was expecting a nice, breezy chat about a happy musical. But this is where it gets weirdly fascinating. When you actually dig into the production history of the 2016 revival, which is our focus, you realize this isn't a story about a happy show. It's basically a disaster management masterclass.
That is a very fair assessment. Yeah. It's less of a revival and more of a rescue mission.
We're looking at a case study of how you take a piece of theater that was fundamentally broken, and I mean structurally unsound, and you just rebuild it from the ground up.
Yeah. And the central question we have to answer is this: how do you take a show that was famously written as a star vehicle, I mean, designed entirely around one specific pop star's charisma in the 1960s,
Right.
and completely reinvent it so it works for a modern audience that doesn't even care about that star anymore?
Before we get to the how, I need to address the what, because I was looking at the background section and I actually had to double check this. This happy-go-lucky banjo strumming musical is based on a novel by H.G. Wells.
It is.
The H.G. Wells,
Yeah.
the War of the Worlds guy, the time machine guy.
The very same.
I am struggling to connect the dots here. I mean, we have Martian tripods destroying London, we have time travel paradoxes, and then we have a musical about a draper's apprentice.
Right.
Did H.G. Wells have a secret phase where he just wanted to write rom-coms or something?
Well, this is a really common misconception about Wells. We remember the sci-fi because, it's flashy. But Wells was a socialist. He was deeply obsessed with the British class system and the crushing weight of social expectations. The musical is based on his 1905 semi-autobiographical novel called Kipps.
Excellent.
And Kipps isn't fluffy. It's actually a pretty sharp, sometimes brutal look at how hard it is to move between social classes in Edwardian England. The musical adapts that, sure, but the source material is surprisingly gritty.
So it's all social climbing and class warfare, just disguised with a smile and a banjo.
Exactly. But the problem wasn't the H.G. Wells novel. The problem was the 1963 musical adaptation.
And this brings us to what the sources are calling the Tommy Steele problem. Now, for anyone under the age of, say, 60, who is Tommy Steele?
In the 1960s, he was Britain's first real homegrown rock and roll star. Think of him as a mix of like Elvis Presley and a very cheeky, very charismatic vaudeville entertainer. He was huge.
So the original 1963 show was built for him.
Built for him is, putting it mildly, it was a vehicle. And when we say star vehicle in theater, we usually mean the lead gets the best songs. But here, the structure was completely lopsided.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to look at that stat in the production notes again.
I circled this in red ink. In the original version, Tommy Steele featured in 12 of the musical's 15 songs.
12 out of 15.
That's not a musical. That's a concert where the singer occasionally stops to talk to the people.
Precisely. Imagine you go to see a movie starring Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson.
Yeah.
You aren't there for the plot.
No.
You're there to see The Rock lift heavy things and be charming. If the plot makes no sense, it doesn't matter because The Rock is
All
there.
right.
That was the 1963 Half a Sixpence. It relied entirely on Steele's personal charisma to bridge the gaps in the story. He would stop the plot to do a banjo solo or a little vaudeville routine, and the audience loved it. But if you take Tommy Steele out of the equation,
You're left with a script that has huge holes in it.
the show collapses. It has no engine.
So fast forward to 2016. Cameron Mackintosh, the producer, decides he wants to bring this show back, but he can't just hire another Tommy Steele.
No, that kind of variety star charisma doesn't really exist in the same way anymore. And modern audiences demand a story that actually makes sense.
You can't just rely on a celebrity smiling for 2 hours. You need a narrative spine.
Exactly.
So they called in the heavy hitters. The Avengers of British musical theater.
It really was an all-star creative team. You have Cameron Mackintosh producing the man behind Les Mis, Phantom Hamilton in London.
But the writer they brought in to fix the book, this is where the H.G. Wells connection starts to make sense again. They hired Julian Fellowes.
The creator of Downton Abbey.
See, on paper, that sounds weird. You have the banjo musical and you hire the guy known for, repressed dinners and tweed suits. Why him?
Because if you strip away the banjo, what is this story? It's about a working class boy who suddenly gets rich and tries to navigate high society.
Oh, okay.
He's uncomfortable at dinner parties. He doesn't know which fork to use. The upper class looks down on him.
That is literally the plot of Downton Abbey.
It is fella's bread and butter. He understands that upstairs downstairs dynamic better than anyone. He was brought in to ground the story. To make the upper class characters, like the Walsinghams, feel like genuine threats to the protagonist's happiness, not just cartoon villains.
So he gives this show its brain back.
Oh, its teeth.
And you have the music. They brought in George Stiles and Anthony Drew.
And this is a reunion, by the way. McIntosh, Fellows, Stiles, Drew, and the director Rachel Kavanagh. This is largely the same team that adapted Mary Poppins for the stage.
Which makes sense. Mary Poppins also had that issue of beloved movie, but we need to make it work on stage.
Exactly. They have a shorthand. They know how to take a property that feels a bit dusty or nostalgic and give it a modern theatrical spine without losing the charm.
But here's my question about the music.
Yeah.
The source material says they did a hybrid approach. They kept the old songs by David Henniker, but Stiles and Dre wrote new ones.
They did.
Usually when musicals do that, it's a mess. You can tell which songs are 1963 and which are 2016. It's like pasting a Ferrari engine into a Model T.
It is a huge risk. But their goal wasn't just to add more songs. It was to fix the narrative flow. Well, remember the Tommy Steele problem. In the old show, a song might happen just because Tommy needed a dance break. In the new version, every single song has to move the plot forward.
Yeah.
So Stiles and Drew had to reorchestrate the old hits to make them sound like they belonged in a story, and then write new songs that bridge the emotional gaps.
Okay, let's look at the track list, because I think this is where you can really see the Julian Fellowes influence blending with the music. You've obviously got the hits, Half a Sixpence, If the Rain's Gotta Fall.
And Flash Bang Wallop.
Which is just a banger. You can't cut that.
You cannot cut that. It's the tentpole. It holds the roof up.
But look at the new material in Act Two. I was reading down the list, and the story just jumps out at you. You don't even need a synopsis.
What stood out?
Well, you have this one song, We'll Build a Palace. It's sung by Arthur Kipps, the main guy. And the Walsinghams, the rich family he gets involved with.
Right. We'll build a palace. It sounds grand, ambitious. It represents the life Arthur thinks he wants. It's high society. It's impressive. It's kind of cold.
But then, almost immediately, in conflict with it, you have a song called I Only Want a Little House.
And there it is. That's the central conflict of the entire show distilled into two song titles. The Palace versus The Little House.
High society versus humble roots. It's amazing how simple that is.
That's the musical theater way of doing what H.G. Wells did in 400 pages. In the 1963 version, that nuance was just lost. Here, the songs are doing the heavy lifting.
So they fixed the book, they fixed the music. Now they just need a star. Mm. And this is where we get into some serious backstage drama.
The sliding doors moment.
The sources mention that when the show was first announced for the Chichester Festival Theater, they had a lead. It was Brian Dick.
A solid established actor.
He was on the poster, he was in the press release, and then he withdraws. The notes say he left to do a production of Hobson's Choice in the West End.
Which is a respectable play.
Respectable, sure. But can we just pause for a second and imagine how Brian Dick feels right now? Because what happened next is basically the plot of A Star Is Born.
It really is. With the lead actor gone, the creative team did something risky. They didn't go for another name. They looked at the chorus, and they found a young man named Charlie Stimp.
A total newcomer.
Effectively, yes. Wow. I mean, he had done some ensemble work, Wicked and Mamma Mia, but he had never carried a show. And you have to remember, this is a role that was built for a superstar. The stamina required is insane.
Oh, yeah.
You are on stage for almost the entire show. You're dancing, you're singing, you're playing the banjo.
Talk about pressure. Hey, see this show that collapsed without a pop icon? You carry it now.
And the result was explosive. I saw this production and the energy when he came on stage. It was like watching a young Danny Kaye. It wasn't just that he was good, it was that he was tireless.
The awards back that up. I'm looking at the list here. What's on stage award for best actor in a musical?
And an Olivier Award nomination for best actor.
Your debut lead role? That's unheard of.
It validated the entire experiment. It proved that if you build a strong show, if you fix the script and the score, you don't need a celebrity to sell it. The show makes the celebrity.
And it wasn't just him, was it? It really became an ensemble piece.
That's the key. In 1963, the other characters were just cardboard cutouts for Tommy Steele to bounce off of. In 2016, you have Emma Williams as Helen Walsingham winning Best Supporting Actress.
Right.
You have Ian Bartholomew getting nominated. The Julian Fellowes treatment meant that everyone on that stage had a real character arc.
So the show opens in Chichester. It's a smash.
A huge smash.
And then it transfers to the West End.
To the Noel Coward Theater.
Now, usually these nostalgia revivals have a limited shelf life. They run for 12 weeks. And then they're gone. But this one kept extending.
It extended three times. It ran for about a year, totaling around 400 performances. In the current West End climate, for a title that isn't, you know, The Lion King or Phantom, that is a massive success.
And unlike so many shows that close and just vanish into the ether, this one stuck around.
Yeah. They preserved it.
We have a cast recording.
Recorded live, wow. Which is rare. Usually they go into a studio. But the producers knew that the energy of this show, that specifically Charlie Stemp energy, needed an audience. So they recorded it during the final nights at Chichester.
I love live albums. You can hear the room reacting. It feels electric.
And then, even better, Sky Arts filmed the West End production in 2021. So this fix is now permanently documented.
Now, I want to pivot to something I noticed in the licensing section of our notes. It's a small detail, essentially a footnote, but I feel like it unlocks the whole strategy here.
The name change.
Yeah. The show isn't just called Half a Sixpence anymore.
No. If you want to license this show for your local theater group today, you are licensing Kipps the New Half, a Sixpence musical.
And the Sky Arts broadcast was just titled Kipps.
Correct.
Explain the logic to me. Because in marketing, brand is king, right? Half a Sixpence is the brand. People know the title. Why would you throw that away and call it Kipps?
Because the producers realized that the brand was actually the problem.
How so?
If you say Half a Sixpence to someone in the industry, or even just a regular ticket buyer, they think of the 1960s. They think of Tommy Steele. They think of a fluffy, sort of insubstantial variety show.
They think of the car with no engine.
Exactly. By rebranding it as Kipps, they are signaling a massive shift in identity. They are aligning the show back with H.G. Wells.
Okay. That makes sense.
They are saying, this isn't a star vehicle anymore. This is a story. It emphasizes the character of Arthur Kipps and the social commentary. It tells potential directors, this is a substantial piece of theater, not just a nostalgia trip.
That is fascinating. It's almost like admitting, we know the old one was flawed. This is the new model.
It's confident. It's saying the fix is stronger than the original brand.
So let's zoom out a bit. We started this deep dive looking at a poster of a guy with a banjo, thinking it was just a simple, happy show. But it really seems like a lesson in adaptation.
It is. It's a lesson that improving something doesn't mean just polishing the surface. You can't just put a fresh coat of paint on a house with a crumbling foundation.
You have to call in Julian Fellowes to redo the foundation.
You have to strip it back to the studs. They went back to the novel. They asked, what is this story actually about? And they rebuilt it from there.
And in the process, they didn't just save a show. They launched a career. I mean, poor Brian Dick, but
I'm sure he's doing fine. But yes, the industry got a new leading man in Charlie Stemp out of the deal.
It's a pretty incredible turnaround.
Uh-huh.
From a lopsided one-man show in 1963 to a perfectly balanced, award-winning ensemble piece in 2016.
It just proves that no story is truly dead if you have the right team to reimagine it.
So as we wrap up, what is the one big thing you want our listener to take away from this?
I think it comes back to that name change. We live in a world obsessed with IP and brand recognition. Oh. Everything has to be a sequel or a remake with the exact same title.
Right.
But here's a production that said the story is more important than the brand. They were willing to change the name to Kipps to save the soul of the show. So it raises a provocative question. Does the brand of a classic matter less than the strength of its original story?
Huh.
If the story is good enough, maybe you don't need the famous title to sell it.
Maybe the story really is king. And on that note, we'll leave you to ponder the value of a good story versus a famous name. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into Half a Sixpence, or maybe you should say Kipps. We'll catch you next time.